Zella Margossian. And we have a special guest in the studio right now. We have the Honourable Jackie Munro. Welcome to the studio, Jackie.
Good morning, Kina. It's fabulous to be here.
I wanted to ask you a couple of questions, kind of about music and your kind of experiences with music and that kind of thing. Ashley, just tell me a little bit about your role in contemporary Australian politics first.
Of course. Well, I am in the New South Wales Parliament. Mm-hmm. I was elected last year in the state election. So
amazing.
Yes, I'm a member of the Legislative Council and actually the Liberal Party's youngest woman member ever elected to the upper house.
And incredible. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And first openly LGBTQI Liberal woman from New South Wales to ever be elected. So
That is quite a record. Congratulations. That's incredible.
I feel like it's not necessarily that exciting in this day and age, but may as well note it, given it's a first.
Well, exactly. It's a first. So it is exciting. Well done.
Thank you.
Fantastic. So I just got a couple of little fun little questions. Did you enjoy music as a child and what instruments did you learn?
Definitely. I loved music. I was really, really lucky to have a little upright piano growing up in the house. And
cool.
I actually still have that little upright piano in my house now.
Wow.
So it's traveled a long way. And that really allowed me to explore music just for fun.
Yeah.
Like just sitting down and playing and then getting a teacher. And amazingly, when I was in primary school, I was the happy beneficiary of the recorder lessons that I'm not sure if they were mandatory in every school. And I was lucky enough to have a school that did produce the instruments for us, and we had tenor recorders and descants, and I was a descant girl because I am quite small and I have very little hands. So I ended up playing at the Opera House with about 600 other students from across New South Wales.
Fantastic.
Which I'm sure our parents had to sit through with gritted teeth, but they did so with enthusiasm.
Fantastic.
And that actually led me to the saxophone because the
similar fingering.
Exactly right. Mm. So it was a bit of a gateway instrument for me, the recorder. I mean, a lot of people tease it as being a very painful experience.
Yeah, but played well. It's very beautiful, isn't it? Actually, that whole program of getting groups of recorder players from all over the state to do big performances at Sydney Opera House is still going. And yeah, at my kids' school, it's quite a big thing. And the recorder played well, for example, by Alicia Crossley, who's a fantastic kind of contemporary recorder player, is very beautiful. But yeah, unfortunately, the kids don't always practice enough to kind of get to that level.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I was ever very good at practicing either, which is why I became such a good sight reader.
Yeah,
It really helped me playing jazz in big bands.
Totally. Oh,
enjoyable.
You played jazz in big bands. Tell me more.
Yeah, all through high school, I played sax. I went from alto to tenor. And because,
as
of
you
course,
got
you
bigger.
Always, yeah, yeah, I got a bit bigger, but also you always need a tenor.
Yeah.
A baritone was definitely out of my reach from a size perspective, but it was, it was a really good way. Like our school, Caringbah High School down in the Sutherland Shire, had a fantastic music program.
Uh-huh.
We have wonderful teachers who are really dedicated. And I'm actually, it's sort of come full circle a little bit for me now because although I was lucky enough to play throughout high school and then into university with the Sydney University Jazz Society, and actually even with the SEMA Women in Jazz program.
Oh, you went to those sessions, did you?
Yeah,
oh,
it was really good.
Wow.
Jess Green was involved.
Serious. And
yeah, it was excellent.
Fantastic.
It was really fun. But now in my role as a politician in the Upper House in New South Wales, we're running an arts and music education inquiry, which is all around how students are given their lessons of music in primary school in particular. And unfortunately, not as many students as I would have hoped to have been as fortunate as I have been. And it should be a normal part of the curriculum. It's supposed to be mandatory, but a lot of students are missing out now because teachers don't feel confident.
I completely agree. Yeah. I mean, I've got 10-year-old twins, as you know, and they go to an inner west public school, and they're very, very lucky because the teacher running it, I'm sure I can say his name, Mr. Jason Isaac. He's been there for 25 years building up the program. It's absolutely brilliant. There's like there's six ensembles in a small primary school. They get lots of performing opportunities, and both my kids are in the jazz band. They play at Lazy Bones. They play at various different events all over Sydney, festivals sometimes. And he gets 9, 10-year-olds to stand up and improvise, and they absolutely love it. So my daughter plays saxophone and my son plays drum set. And the kind of respect in the school that's given to music is really special, and they feel like they're part of something greater. And most of the time, kids do enjoy music if you kind of get the genre right and you make it kind of exciting enough, especially if it's a social thing as well. I think ensembles is incredibly important. I mean, I'm a flute and piano teacher. I've been doing it for 25 years. And yeah, I spend time in my one-on-one lessons, like really trying to kind of hone in on that what makes that student tick, what's going to kind of excite them, give them enough to work on. So so they're going to get better, but not bored, and all that kind of stuff. And honestly, I hardly ever lose students, because music is everywhere. Music is life. If you get the genre right, that kid is gonna love music forever. I mean, you know, I believe in teaching a whole range of styles, from like classical, jazz, you know, chord reading, you know, pop, folk, whatever. And really, it's everywhere. I mean, some of my students play computer game music. You know, some of them play pop songs. Some of them play the classical repertoire. So, I mean, I think it's very important. Obviously, there's a lot of studies that have shown that music education improves lots of aspects of education, including focus, including teamwork, including behavior. There's a lot of studies around that from all over the world. But as well as that, it gives them that confidence and builds self-esteem, especially if they go to places that are not even necessarily school events, where they can see people are respecting them. I think it's very, very powerful. But what I wanted to mention, sorry, I just went on that rant then.
No, it's fabulous. I think it's so good. And actually, there's an Australian researcher, Professor Anita Collins, who has done a lot of that neuropsychological research that demonstrates everything you were saying, that scientific basis that music actually changes the brain for the better and helps us in all other aspects of our life, whether, as you said, it is focus or it's communication, it's giving our brain a neuroplasticity that allows us to enjoy life more fundamentally. So yeah, totally.
Absolutely.
Get where you're coming
and
from.
Whatever these kids end up doing later, they can read music very well. You know, a bunch of them can improvise well. They appreciate music. They know a bunch of composers. So that's always, at the very least, going to be like a fun little side thing in their life, a way to connect with people, you know, a way to spend their free time, which is always good for their mental health as well. But yeah, I wanted to mention that a lot of the schools near the school that my kids go to have no music program at all. It's shocking. It was just like luck of the draw. We just happened to be 3 minutes from an amazing school for music. I mean, it's pretty normal in every other way, but it's just the school down the road, literally like 10-minute walk down the road, has no music program at all. And I teach a bunch of kids from that school, and I kind of said, oh, that's really surprising, because there's heaps of musicians in this area. And they just said, just no one set it up. It's not a standard thing. And I just think that's pretty unfortunate for those kids. Because I think once they hit high school, because, you know, I've been teaching for a long time, once they hit high school, I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's a lot harder for them to start an instrument from scratch, because often, you know, their personalities kind of coming out by then, and they don't want to put in the time to like practice regularly to actually get better at an instrument. Whereas if they start, you know, when they're anywhere between, I mean, I have 4-year-old beginner piano students, but really anywhere up to maybe 8 or 9, if they've done the hard yards already, then by the time they're like 12, they're quite good already. And then it's fun. And then they see the point of it. But yeah, I just think it's really unfortunate. One of my first flute teachers, his name was Vladimir Svetkovic, and he was from Serbia. Before the war and the conflict and all that, it was compulsory in schools for all children to learn at least one instrument. It was fully funded by the government. And you know, so many brilliant musicians came out of that area. And is that something that you would be focusing on, or you'd be kind of looking into? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've spent quite a lot of time in our parliamentary committee inquiry speaking to professionals in the industry, to researchers, academics. We've visited schools with lots of different types of programs.
Mm.
And certainly what we found is, although it is supposed to be a compulsory unit even in primary school, unfortunately, it's very dependent on whether the teacher or teachers in the school, the school leadership, have a sense of how important music is for education, not just in and of itself, which is important, but also for the development of learning in other areas. And I think this can even be traced back to our teachers getting enough time during their teaching degrees learning about music, because we've heard from a teacher who went through her first teacher training probably about 40 years ago.
Wow.
And she was talking about how teachers really had to learn the piano. That was part of their teaching degree, that they had to have some basic understanding of how to play piano and read music.
Just for a primary school education degree.
Yeah,
wow.
That's right. So we've obviously shifted a lot in terms of the time and focus that we spend on actually teaching teachers. And there are interesting workarounds. So we've got evidence about companies that are basically coming in and running like digital lessons. So they've pre-recorded videos that match the syllabus and go through the curriculum so that it's easy for a teacher to
put on the video.
Exactly right. And you've obviously got classrooms now that are very well set up in their AV and very much more advanced even than when I was in school.
Definitely. Yeah.
And that's a way to aid teachers through the curriculum and still ensure that children are getting that musical education. It might not be quite as one-on-one, but at least they're getting something that's really valuable and in line with what they should be getting. And honestly, it's been demonstrated that even 5 minutes at the beginning of the day, where you have the classroom coming in, they've maybe had a bit of a noisy morning out in the playground, and they come into the classroom and they have 5 minutes of clapping and movement and a bit of singing together.
Mm.
Even that 5 minutes calms them right down, makes them feel like they're part of a community, really, with each other, and gives them a sense of kind of locking into a rhythm of the brain, really.
Yeah, sounds fantastic. Mm. I mean, I need music in my life every day.
So. So do I.
So do you have a favourite genre?
I do love jazz. I'm not just saying it because I'm here and I'm a long-time listener of Eastside. I have to say, very early on, when I was in high school, I actually won tickets through an Eastside radio competition to an Emma Pask and James Morrison
gig. Oh, wow,
yeah.
Fantastic. They're incredible.
Yeah, so good. I mean, this was probably 20 years ago. So it was, it was really a part of my growing up, but definitely jazz and lots of different styles. I mean, as a saxophonist, I've always loved bebop and that era in particular, but I've really also loved, like you just played Jeremy Rose, like modern Australian jazz. I went down to the Wangaratta Jazz Festival when I was in year 12.
It was
a little road trip, and that was the first time that I saw the Vampires and absolutely loved them. And
fantastic.
I think, our Australian jazz scene is just so cool.
It is. Yeah. It absolutely is. Actually, my son's drum teacher is the drummer for the Vampires.
Oh my gosh, that is so cool.
Alex Masso.
Wow. Yeah. Well, yeah. James Loughnan was my saxophone teacher growing up in high school, and he's definitely still around playing. And it's just such a nice community. I really appreciate that people stick around. Like, it's not always the easiest career, but it's just full of passion and dedication and love.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's plenty of that, and there's a camaraderie there as well, you know, but between musicians, which is really great.
Definitely. And I would say my two other favorite styles, I love techno, and I also love drum and bass.
Excellent. Yeah, as my daughter's discovered jazz this year in the jazz band, she absolutely loves it. Like, I used to have a problem with her not practicing, but now sometimes I actually can't get her to stop. Like, she loves playing the jazz pieces so much.
Well, yeah. That's a great problem to have.
Absolutely. I never thought I'd have that problem, but like, it might be like 9:30 or 10 and she's still going through it, and I'm like, Lyra, please stop. Gonna get to bed. Yeah, she just loves it though. And what I love about saxophone is it feels like it's straight away, it's cool and it's amazing. Before you've even picked it up, right? And, you know, just even if you play, it feels to me like even if you play the wrong note, it still sounds great.
I'll take that. Maybe that's why I loved it so much. There was no such thing as wrong. It's just an edgy note.
Yeah, exactly.
Adding some color.
Exactly. Chromaticism.
Yes.
Okay. So what would you say is your favorite piece of music that has come out of Australia recently? And we can have a little listen to that in a minute too.
That sounds good. So I have two that I sent you because I wasn't sure how recent was recent, but I really loved in April the release of Sleep Makes Waves' new album. It is so good, and their opening track, All Hail Skull, is just so powerful. It's really cool. So that album, as a full kind of concept album, start to finish, is exceptional, but the opening track is very powerful and epic.
Fantastic. And is it okay if we listen to that now?
Definitely.
Yeah, cool. Okay, I just got to set this up. So, have you been following this band for a while, or is it? Why do you like that style?
So I actually went to uni with he's a front man, and they always have been the kind of group that relies on their skill and their passion in a way that is very clear in their music. So, I love the effort that they put into this album. Like, it's a few years coming, and you feel the talent and their raw interaction through their music is just, I find it quite powerful. So
fantastic.
Yeah.
And Sleep Makes Waves. What does that mean exactly?
That is a great question. I don't know.
I guess we'll work it out.
Yeah. I always thought that maybe it's about your brain waves, but I don't know if that's actually true.
Okay, we'll take a listen. This is a track, It's Here But I Have No Names For It, by Sleep Makes Waves. Hope you enjoy.
It's in the dark of night, but fades at dawn. Thank you.
And that was such a beautiful track by Sleep Makes Waves. Thanks for suggesting it, Jackie.
Pleasure. Thanks for putting it on.
So I just want to have had a few more questions that I'm really curious about. What are your experiences as a woman in politics? Big question, I know.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because obviously I don't have an experience of being a man in politics.
True.
It's something obviously that I get asked a lot, and I think from like I was in the Young Liberals when I was in uni and throughout my 20s, and I ended up becoming the female vice president of the Young Liberals, which is a spot that is put aside as a spot for a woman, and we've had that for many, many years. But I think it had this interesting psychological impact on me because I felt a little bit like, I mean, this is a kind of derogatory term, but a quota girl, that I was only there because of my gender. And I think that gave me, like, it really gave me a sense that I didn't deserve to be there, unfortunately. No. So I think that's a lot of, like, internalized sexism, perhaps, but it didn't feel very good, and I think it probably stopped me from doing as much as I wanted to or standing up for things that I wanted to. And I suppose I'm glad I had that lesson early on, because since then, with the benefit of hindsight and a little bit more wisdom, I've been able to say, well, if I'm there and if I'm here, I'm going to do as much as I can to do as much good as I can.
Fantastic.
And that's really the lesson out of it. So I say that to women now. I know a lot of people feel that kind of imposter syndrome. A lot of women feel that. But my message is always to say that if you're in a position, just make the most of it. Make as much as you possibly can of it. It will open up other opportunities for you. And I think that I was actually at an event last night, and Joe Hockey was the guest speaker, and I spoke to him afterwards and said, oh yeah, you know, I'm the youngest Liberal woman in the upper house. And he said, oh yeah, how old were you? And I said, I was 32 when I was elected. And he said, oh, that's nothing. I was 32 when I was elected to the federal parliament. And my friend said, yes, but you're not a woman.
Exactly. I think it's a bit different.
Yeah. He said it jokingly and offhand. It wasn't malicious at all, but
that's the attitude. Yeah.
I think it's good to remember that we've got to celebrate whatever milestones we can, because
absolutely,
progress is where progress is, I guess, where we want to go. I mean, we want change for the better. We want a more diverse representation of people in politics. And certainly, like, I don't like to talk about my sexuality in particular because it doesn't really matter in the sense that who cares what my sexuality is, but I say it to share with people that actually the Liberal Party does have diversity in it, that it's not necessarily what people might think it is from the outside. And we have an amazing diversity of opinions and people and backgrounds, and our people, our representatives in Parliament, for example, like I'm the Shadow Assistant Minister for Arts and the 24-Hour Economy, but our Shadow Minister for Arts, the Honourable Kevin Anderson, he is a Nationals member from Tamworth, and he is also a touring working musician.
Oh, really?
He's an incredible...
What instrument does he play?
He's a guitar player and a singer, so he's a front man for an incredible band, and they tour around New South Wales, and he's also an MP, he's also a representative, and he brings that experience of being in the arts, of actually having that on-the-ground understanding of how the industry works and how musicians are feeling. So I think...
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are some interesting... That there seems to be a little bit of a link between music and politics. It just suddenly came to my mind that Emmanuel Macron from France started out as a classical pianist.
And
he trained at some conservatoire. So the options for him were either music or politics. Two very difficult areas.
Interesting. We have definitely had a couple of famous musician politicians. I think Bill Clinton on the saxophone is also one of the famous examples.
I would love to see you in Parliament House playing that saxophone one day before you die. You've got to do it, right?
I'll let you know. You'll be the first to get an invitation.
And what is the Liberal Party policy towards music and the arts in Australia?
Well, amazingly, because of the leadership of our arts ministers, I mean, when we were in government, we really made some huge strides in the arts. Mm. And a bit of a mentor of mine, Don Harwin, was just an incredible force in ensuring that arts was at the forefront of the cabinet's mind for the coalition government in New South Wales. And he ended up putting about $2.5 billion into the arts and cultural institutions, which was a record investment. And that included like revitalization of Walsh Bay Precinct, the Powerhouse Museum, and the reopening of the Royal in Sydney, the mm-hmm. Royal Theatre. Mm-hmm. There was saving the National Art School, actually, in Darlinghurst was another big one. So there was actually a real focus. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to recognise that that's what it takes. It takes focus. Mm. It doesn't – support for the arts doesn't happen accidentally. No. And we obviously –
usually they get left behind.
That's right. That's right. And Don was just this incredible force. He understood the value of arts and music and culture, and he backed it in. And he backed it in with money. And that's what it takes. Like you need someone in cabinet when you've got a party in government who will actually stand up for the arts in a tangible way. Mm. So yeah, I think we've got a great legacy actually. And actually that includes the doubling of the art gallery as well. Mm. We've obviously got the new modern art gallery that is next to the original art gallery. And it is about expanding those cultural institutions. And
sounds great.
Yeah. I think the other one I would say, which is a little bit more recent, is the festivals bill is going through Parliament at the moment, and it's a bill designed to help festivals get back on their feet.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems that festivals have been talking about is the fees and charges that are put on by government requirements.
Absolutely,
like policing.
Yeah.
Mm. And Kevin, as our Shadow Arts Minister, called on the government to waive all government fees associated with festivals doing business and getting up and running. So sounds that's great. The kind of thing that we're advocating for.
Mm. Fantastic. That sounds brilliant. And do you have any kind of last remarks to kind of mention about music and Australia and the value of music to the Australian community?
I mean, as we were saying before, there's music is something magical. There's nothing like it. It's so like having sound waves, vibrations in the air that make us feel something and make us feel together. And there's science saying that people who attend music festivals are happier than people who don't. Like, music is just such a core part of being human. And I love that radio stations like Eastside are a part of the community and obviously have people like yourselves who are dedicated to keeping that community alive. And I just, yeah, thank you so much for all the work you do here, obviously at Eastside, but also in the community more broadly, like to all the music teachers, to all the parents who ensure that their kid has an instrument, whether it's a ukulele or a recorder or a tuba. It's just such an important part of being human. So, yeah, it's fabulous to be able to celebrate it wherever I can.
Thanks so much, Jackie, and thanks for coming into the studio.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to have a listen now to Just Be With Me by Diane Cripps and her band. So this was released last year, and it's kind of like a jazz ballad album. They're all her original songs. Hope you enjoy.
That's what we do when we get here.